Good morning, everyone. I hope you can hear me without a microphone, as this doesn't seem to be operative. I'm not going to attribute the large turnout to my amazing popularity, because I know there's no competition this morning. That's why you've ended up here. It's like students who used to tell me they were in my class because it was the only one that fitted their schedule. Not very reassuring. I hope you've all got a handout, because it's not going to make a lot of sense without it. I need to tell you, as you probably guessed, if you've got the side that says Epiphany or Theophany at the top, which is where we're starting, that we're actually not going to do this three-week series in terms of Advent, Christmas and Epiphany in that order, but we're going to do it in the reverse order. Now, this is not just because I like to be perverse, but because, as you'll see, it makes sense in historical terms to do it that way round. There's no sign in the New Testament at all as to when in the year Jesus was born. There are signs about when he died, but nothing about when he was born. So all the stuff about in the deep midwinter and so on is simply the imagination of 19th century carol writers, and we simply don't know that it was winter. And indeed, we'd not really expect the writers of the New Testament to spend their time trying to work out when exactly Jesus was born, because they imagined that Christ would return very soon, certainly within their lifetime, and they were more focused on that than the details of when he happened to be born. And so it's not until after the New Testament period, when expectations that Jesus' return would be imminent had really declined, and people began to accept that it wasn't going to be very soon, and so became more concerned with the here and now, and more concerned with some facts about the past. I've entitled this session Epiphany or Theophany, because both terms are used. More commonly in the churches of the East, that's the Eastern Mediterranean, Russian Orthodox, Byzantine Orthodox, and so on, Theophany is the title of the feast on January the 6th, rather than Epiphany, which is a more common title in the churches of the West, the Latin-speaking churches. And this is true down to this day. Epiphany simply means revelation or appearance, and theophany, as you may have guessed, means the appearance of God, the divine revelation. So I've given you an extract there from a theologian known as Clement of Alexandria, because that's where he came from, writing round about the year 200, and it's an interesting passage that I'd like you to look at now. Don't worry too much about the strange names of the months. After all, these were Coptic names, they're not likely to be one familiar to you, so that's why I've put in brackets the equivalent dates in the Western calendar. Well, there are several things that are interesting about this passage. One, that apparently people are not only trying to work out when, not only the year, but the date of Christ's birth, and they come up with a variety of conclusions. Some, as you see, took place on the 20th, I think the birth took place on the 20th of May. the followers of Basilides, I'll come back to him in a minute, hold that the day of his baptism, they keep it as a festival, but apparently they're not entirely agreed which date it was. Some think it was the 10th of January, and others think it's the 6th of January. And we get a similar attempts to calculate the date of his death. So, other answers are given right at the last sentence of this, that it was on the 19th or 20th of April. So, people are now beginning to try and work out not only the date of his death, but the date of his birth. They're coming to different conclusions. But among those conclusions is January the 6th. But it seems that it's the followers of this person, Basilides, who are figuring out that date, or some of them anyway, are figuring out that date. And they are figuring out not his date of his birth, but rather the date of his baptism. That is clearly more important to them. Now, apart from the followers of Basilides, nobody seems at this state to be holding what we would think of as a Christmas festival on any of the dates that are mentioned. They're simply the dates people are calculating. But the followers of Basilides stand out because they are apparently holding a festival on one or both of those dates, and it's a festival of Christ's baptism, which is clearly more important to them. Well, that's an interesting start. We start not with birth, but with baptism among a group of Basilides' followers. Now, Basilides was, is now regarded as a heretic because the rest of the church didn't eventually agree with him. You need to understand about heretics that, by and large, they're not the sort of people who have gone off at a tangent away from what everybody else thinks. By and large, they're the people who are old-fashioned, sticking to earlier ideas when the rest of the church has moved on. So they've become out of step by staying in step, if you see what I mean. And this is true of most heretics throughout the ages. A, they lost, and B, they're usually old-fashioned and continue to hold views that everybody once held, but nobody does anymore. And this was true about Basilides and his followers. But why are they emphasizing the baptism of Jesus rather than his birth? Move on to the second piece of evidence, the gospel, the beginning of Mark's gospel. I've printed this out because I wasn't sure you'd all remember what's in Mark's gospel at the very beginning. So to avoid embarrassment this morning, I've printed that out. I want you to suppose that the only gospel you have, or at least the only one you think is authoritative, you may have heard of or even read bits of other early Christian writings. Remember, we have no New Testament as such, no authoritative body of writings that are regarded as inspired in the same sense as the Old Testament. We don't get that for about another 100 years afterwards. If you have this, then this is what you would read, and this is how you would envisage that Jesus was the Christ. There is no birth story in Mark. The birth stories are only in Matthew and in Luke. Mark starts off with a grown-up John the Baptist and a grown-up Jesus. And so, towards the foot of the first page, we have John baptizing in the wilderness and proclaiming a baptism of repentance for remission of sins, and people are coming out to him to be baptized, he apparently announces at the foot of the page and over that there's one coming after me who's mightier than I. It's in the and thou language because that avoids the problems of copyright. Whereas if I printed out the NRSV, there'll be copyright issues. So, So all my students as undergraduates had to have booklets that were full of 19th century translations of ancient Christian writers, because they were free of copyright. So John proclaims that someone mightier than he is coming, and who will baptize them with the Holy Spirit. And lo and behold, in this paragraph, next paragraph, it came to pass in those days that Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. And straightway, coming up out of the water, he saw the heavens rent asunder, and the Spirit as a dove descending upon him. And a voice came out of heaven, "Thou art my beloved Son, in thee I am well pleased." As I say, if you only had this, you would not be thinking of Jesus as having had a miraculous birth. And indeed, you would know that all the great leaders of the past of Israel from its very beginnings had been men, and I'm afraid it was always men, who had been apparently chosen by God, and it was revealed in some way or another that they were to be great leaders. Moses, for example, did not have a miraculous birth. Moses was brought up in the Pharaoh's palace, and it was only when he was grown up that he had this encounter with God in the burning bush and was told he was going to lead the people to freedom. King David did not have a miraculous birth. He was simply, identified by the prophet as the one who was to lead Israel, and we have the contest between him and Goliath and so on. So it would be natural for people to think that when the Messiah came, he would be an ordinary man who would then be selected by God to be the one who was to redeem Israel. Okay, so not surprising then, Mark's gospel seems to take that point. Mark mentions nothing about Jesus' earlier life, and here it comes at the beginning of the gospel that he is identified as the Messiah, as God's Son, from at the moment of his baptism, when apparently he receives the Holy Spirit, and a voice from heaven identifies him as the Son of God. At this stage, Son of God need not have meant biological son, nor in some miraculous way a different being from other humans. You could be adopted as God's son. You could be adopted as the leader of Israel and so on. So a quite natural reading of this would be that this is the point at which God chooses and proclaims that Jesus is his son and will be the Messiah. This seems odd to us because we know all the other Gospels and we know the rest of the stories. But it would have seemed the most natural and believable account of how Jesus was the Messiah to people at the very beginning. You're looking stupefied by that, but it's true. And so lots of Christians, no doubt, had that theology. And it's called, as I've placed in a bracket just below, adoptionist Christology. Jesus becomes the Christ by being adopted as God's Son. But, of course, by the time we're talking about, not when Mark's Gospel was written in the middle of the first century, but now at the end of the second, going into the third century, the church in general, or in majority, has moved on, has come to believe what the other Gospels say, and poor old Basilides and his followers are left behind with their strange, old-fashioned views on things. you can no doubt think of religious groups who are rather like that today. So adoptionist Christology, which would have been perfectly respectable at the beginning, is now not so, and Basilides is out on a limb. But apparently it's his group, and his group alone, that is celebrating a feast on January the 6th. We don't know when and how other Christians began to do the same. We haven't got details. We just know that eventually they did, because later writings describe it. What the other Christians celebrate is birth and baptism on January the 6th. I don't mean that they thought that he was born and immediately baptized, like in some sort of emergency baptism. But they celebrate those two events. So it looks as though this whole Christmas stuff as a celebration, not just as some philosophers attempt to calculate dates, starts with Basilides sometime late in the second century, celebrating just baptism, and is taken up by other Christians who keep to the same date, January the 6th, but they everywhere celebrate birth and baptism. I'm going to pause now in case people want to ask questions. I know it's a pain when you have to wait 40 minutes or something to ask your question, or to challenge what I've said. Everybody happy now? I don't know. We shall get through this in no time at all if we don't have some questions and discussions.
I'm curious about whether the Israelites ever celebrated the birth of any of the other.
No, no.
They didn't hear about the birth of Moses.
No. Not only did they not know when it was, they didn't celebrate it either. They, in that sense, they had relatively few festivals, and they're about the nation of Israel rather than about any individual within it. So it's a new idea. I mean, though a lot religions around the ancient world celebrated lots of things, and so I suppose celebrating the baptism was probably more normal, if you could call anything. Oh, by the way, I've had rotator cuff surgery. This is why I'm still wearing this. I thought my doctor was going to let me off it, but now I'll wear it for another week. So.
Go to my next question. You may have already covered this, but are we talking about the same calendar that we have today?
No.
Compared to the 4th century?
There's a string of local calendars. All we're saying is that January the 6th in our calendar was the equivalent, the date of whatever month it is in Egypt, Tubi, if you worked it out, would be the equivalent of January the 6th in our calendar. Christians had problems over Easter particularly, which of course they started with, well, that's another story, but because they wanted to know the date of the Jewish Passover so that they could celebrate Easter. And we know Easter is a movable feast because Passover is a movable feast. And Christians in other countries had problems. They didn't want to go and ask the Jews. It's really embarrassing. Can you tell us the date of your Passover so we can celebrate our... they tried to do calculations, but also, in some cases, decided to make it the equivalent month, since it's the 15th of Nisan in the Jewish calendar, nothing to do with the car. 15th day of the first spring month, they then, in some places, figured out, oh, well, we'll keep it on the 15th day of the first spring month in our calendar in Asia Minor or wherever.
Back to birth, didn't the Roman Empire, at least with some of the emperors, early emperors, celebrate the birth of the emperor?
You may well be right.
Exactly.
I wasn't thinking outside the Jewish.
Miraculous stories about
birth.
Caesar and probably
yeah.
Caesar.
Yeah, yeah. And Alexander, I think. Yes, so you're right. It was not unknown in the ancient world.
I'm not suggesting that the Jews did that at all.
No.
Maybe
is a factor in... Yeah,
the
yeah.
Roman Christians might have...
Yeah, yeah, thought in that term. Yeah, yeah, well, could well be, as we shall discover. This calendar stuff is so complicated that the professor at General Theological Seminary in New York, now deceased, Thomas Talley, of Texan origin. One student was heard coming out of his class saying, "I didn't know we'd have to do higher mathematics when we did." So we have this festival on January the 6th spreading throughout the Mediterranean, particularly the eastern Mediterranean. The churches that were Greek or Syriac speaking adopt January the 6th and celebrate birth and baptism of Jesus together. They obviously didn't want to simply wipe away all reference to baptism and switch to birth, no doubt as a sort of compromise with some Christians who thought it was one and some another. Making it both was a way of, well, if not satisfying everybody, satisfying more people. So the places where we know it took off were largely in the Eastern Mediterranean. It may well have been prevalent in some places in the West, but it certainly was not taken up at Rome or in North Africa, who are always out of step with everybody else. Historically, the development of liturgical practices, Rome and North Africa were always the exception. Everybody else did one thing and they did another. It's one of those quirks of history, of course, that Rome's practice eventually becomes the practice of the Western Church and therefore our practice in our tradition. But at this stage, the one thing I can tell you is that Rome was not apparently celebrating any event, birth or baptism. But maybe some other Western churches were, but certainly it was widespread throughout the East. The one exception we know about is what was going on in Jerusalem. And so I've given you in the last part of this handout, make the most of this handout because next week I'll just talk. I've given you an account of what the Jerusalem church was doing, and it apparently is only celebrating the birth on January the 6th. That's not really terribly surprising because down the road is Bethlehem, just 2 miles away. So inevitably they're going to focus on the birth and indeed, as we shall see in this, go down to Bethlehem to celebrate it. So from their point of view, it was inevitable that baptism would get squeezed out. After all, it was supposed to have taken place further away, which would have been impossible for the Jerusalem church to travel and celebrate it there. Bethlehem was such a big draw in all this that they're the only place that we know of that chose the nativity alone for the focus of the January 6th celebration. And as you can see, all the Christians of Jerusalem on the 5th of January travel down from Jerusalem. It's only a couple of miles. I've walked it myself. It's a perfectly reasonable, be a big procession, but a perfectly doable procession for them to go down there and start off their celebration on the evening of the 5th of January at what is called there the Place of the Shepherds, or Shepherd's Field, but literally it's the Place of the Shepherd, the Place of the Shepherds, where the shepherds were abiding with their flocks by night. Okay? And it's not quite night when they get there. The 10th hour is about 4 p.m. It's not yet dark, but it's obviously evening. and they perform this little service that the text here calls a canon. Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd. Psalm 80, O Shepherd of Israel, here. And Luke's Gospel, chapter 2, verses 8 to 20. That's a funny thing, which if we've time, I'll come back to. Why that reading then? Then they move on to the cave at Bethlehem. Now, since early in the second century, people had claimed to have found the very cave in which Jesus was born. Long before pilgrims started to go in any numbers, the locals could identify the cave at Bethlehem where Jesus had been born. This always seems odd to Westerners as well. I remember being puzzled by this. Doesn't it say he was born in a stable and in a manger and so on? It's quite common in the ancient world for natural caves around the place to be used for storage and for keeping animals. After all, you've only got to put something across the front and you've built your stable. So it's not unlikely that Jesus was born in a cave. Why people thought it was this particular cave, nobody really explains. But of course, by the 4th century, when pilgrims are coming in big numbers, this becomes an important point to make visits to Bethlehem popular and provide income for the locals and so on. There's a big booming industry in the 4th century to find holy places all over the place because it gets folks to come. They're on the tourist track then and provides sources of income in terms of lodging and probably selling souvenirs to the locals. So when they gather in the cave at Bethlehem, they start a night vigil. 12 Old Testament readings, rather like the Easter vigil that we know. Indeed, it is actually a copy of the Easter vigil, I didn't put down all the 12 readings for you, but they're nearly identical to the ones used at Easter, and probably were, when they adopted this, they just copied them from the Jerusalem Easter vigil. And then those are the readings for the Eucharist, that follows after in the middle of the night. Psalm 2, "You are my son, today I have begotten you," which we've seen is used in Mark's Gospel, slightly different wording, but it also turns up in Psalm 2. Titus 2, 11 to 15, whatever it is, it's about appearing, salvation has appeared. Psalm 110 is the Lord said to my Lord, sit on my right hand till I come. It's a messianic psalm. And Matthew 2, 1 to 12 is the account of the visit of the Magi. And then they all go back in the night to Jerusalem, except for the folks who are from Bethlehem, who stay there and have their Christmas celebration there. But the Jerusalem church then travels back to Jerusalem because presumably that's how they'd started this tradition of keeping this feast. And the draw of, well, let's go down to Bethlehem and do it in the actual place is too strong for them. So they, in effect, have an extended celebration with two Eucharists, one in Bethlehem and another back in the what they call the Holy Martyrium in the city, which is the, we would know it as the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, which is their major church. And there are other readings, almost identical to the ones they've done, except for an earlier version of an earlier part of Matthew. So this is going to become important when we, you may already be ahead of me, when we start to talk about the development of midnight mass at Christmas. But since that's Christmas, that's going to be next week. I haven't finished, so let's hope there's still some time. There's plenty. But that's where it ultimately comes from, a vigil leading up to midnight celebration in Bethlehem on the night of 5th to 6th of January. So you can see where that, well, you might see where that's going. I'm saving what on earth were they doing at Rome till next week, because that's the beginning of the true Christmas story. So let me just finish out the story of the Nativity. The story of January the 6th. Well, I'll have to do a brief version for next week, and I'll give you the detail then. That you need to come if you don't want the detail. When eventually Rome does adopt a feast of the birth of Jesus, it's on, guess what? December 25th. What we'll have to talk about next week is what on earth was the reason for them choosing December the 25th. They obviously, everybody else was already doing this on January the 6th, and they don't do anything, so eventually they choose another date. And eventually persuade the rest of the Christian world to follow them. This doesn't mean that January the 6th disappears. It remains in the East as the feast of the baptism of Jesus. Once they've taken the birth away and moved it to Rome's date, they're left with the feast of the baptism of Jesus. So what had been originally the Feast of Nativity and Baptism becomes the Feast of the Baptism of Jesus to this day. And so if you go to Orthodox churches on January the 6th, or if they're the sort of church that still hasn't reformed its calendar and it's on a different date, it's their January the 6th, but not ours, you will find that the focus of the celebration is primarily the baptism of Jesus. Whereas you already know that in the West, when Rome then decides to add January the 6th, they make it the visit of the wise men. That's a great pity, because the visit of the wise men is not theologically as profound as the baptism of Jesus. It's true, it counts as an epiphany. Indeed, they could argue it's the first epiphany of Jesus. It was when the wise men came and revealed it to the world, and that's where you hear countless sermons on January the 6th on the revelation to the world. But I think it's unfortunate, because it loses the much more central celebration of Jesus' baptism. Until modern times, by which I mean my lifetime, there was no feature in the Western calendar, the Roman Catholic Church or the Anglican Church or whatever, for the baptism of Jesus. It just didn't appear. And it's only since the Second Vatican Council that Roman Catholics have added the baptism of Jesus, realizing that it was a significant omission, and they have made it the first Sunday after January the 6th. And since people only go to church on Sundays, effectively now, the West does have a feast of January the 6th that celebrates the baptism of Jesus. There are some traditions where January 6th is important enough for local festivals to be held and people still to go to church. But sadly, for the majority of us, it just becomes another weekday when we don't have time. And mostly then we do actually celebrate, in effect by accident, January 6th. The readings had always been there on that Sunday. It's just that it had never been a festival as such. It was just. But the East, I think, rightly sticks to celebrating the baptism of Jesus, because it is that profound moment when Jesus is publicly revealed as the Messiah, as God's Son. Throughout his childhood, according to the nativity stories we have, whatever the wise men thought when they came and went away again, it doesn't seem to have been commonly known. After all, there wasn't a big audience or the press or anybody there to take note of it and so on. So although it's recorded in Matthew's Gospel, it doesn't seem to have been known to the contemporaries. It's not, you know, we don't hear people discussing with Jesus' mum, do you really think he's the Messiah and so on? There's that incident in Luke's Gospel where he gets lost in Jerusalem and he says these enigmatic things, but it doesn't look as though anybody thought he was the Messiah, the Son of God, until the event here that's described in Mark's Gospel and then picked up by the other two, his baptism by John. So this is really, in historical sense, the public revelation of Jesus as the Christ. And so is, I think, a really significant moment, because obviously this must have given rise to people talking about it and the fame spreading. At this stage he probably had some disciples of his own, but clearly the number of followers increased, and this must have been a very significant factor in bringing that about. As I say, we have plenty of time, so if you'd like to talk about that or anything else. No?
I was just about to ask, how did you get the Magi into baptism? Can you answer?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's just the Roman tradition thought in terms of a number of epiphanies, and that's why, in a sense, theophany is a better title, because it's the revelation of Jesus' divine nature. But the Western tradition thought of a number of occasions where Jesus is revealed, the Magi being one, when allegedly he was revealed to the world, or at least to these strange people from the East. The miracle of water into wine at Cana of Galilee in John's Gospel, where John said, "This, the first of his signs, did Jesus," and so on. So there were a number of those events that were thought of as in the orbit of the Epiphany. And indeed, in the hymn by Christopher Wordsworth, I think. I'm trying to remember the first line. What's the first line? Manifest at Galilee, I can remember. That's not the first line. Well, there's some praise, that's it. Song, yes. If you look it up.
Somebody older than you to remember.
Names and dates I'm not good on. Everything else I know about history, but names and dates I'm really bad. If you look up Christopher Wordsworth, him, he's a late 19th century, I think, mid-19th century. Hymn by Christopher Wordsworth, who was Bishop of Salisbury. It goes through enumerating the various epiphanies. From a theological point of view, it's actually a very interesting hymn, which, of course, we only tend to sing once in the year, which talks about baptism and the other incidents. And so it gives you the whole set of epiphanies. Yeah.
And there's an antiphon sung at the Old Roman Rite for Epiphany, "Behold the Triple Mystery."
And there are one or two other more minor epiphanies, at least have been claimed to be part of that orbit of I think the feeding of the 5,000 is one of them that gets into the tradition. Not never in a big way, but just in preaching and theological discourse and so on. So, yeah, there's that attempt, but somehow, and not surprisingly in a way, the Magi sort of triumphed because it's easier to represent it visually. I mean, there are representatives of Jesus' baptism, but when we get figures for the Nativity and so on, you can have Magi with camels, which aren't mentioned in the story, nor is the number three mentioned in the story.
Or kings,
that's the later medieval, and names for them later on. Magi is usually not translated as wise men because it doesn't quite capture what they were. In one sense, they were wise men, but not just in our modern sense of wise men. They were, well, obviously astrologers because they saw the star, but people who sort of divined things through mysterious ways that only they knew. And so we tend to keep the attribution nowadays, Magi rather than wise men. But so much has been added to the story, the assumption that because they brought gifts of gold, frankincense and myrrh, there must have been three of them, one to carry each one. So, I mean, that's how we get the number three. It isn't in the Bible, but that's how we get the number three. And inevitably, since they've come a long way, they have to come on camels. So they get written into the story as well. As Father Michael was saying, they then come to be thought of as kings later in the Middle Ages and given names. And so there are particular ethnic traditions where the three kings is a big thing. But as I say, in general, it's never been for Western Christians, other than these particular pockets of tradition that have built up. Never been the big event like December the 25th became. And of course, that's what produces the so-called 12 days of Christmas. It's purely coincidental that those dates were chosen. They happen to be 12 days apart. Mind you, it's more difficult to write a song that's on the 13th day of Christmas.
Two questions. The first, to get back to the Magi, I mean, it must be a back formation maybe of importance, because isn't it later reported that they testified to what they had seen and that caused the massacre of all children?
I mean that.
So they had a historical role.
Well, they.
If that happened.
I mean, this is always the problem with the Christmas stories. In the old people's community, sorry, I understand why you're going. In the old people's community where I live, the over 55 active community where I live, I go to a Roman Catholic Bible study by invitation because I wanted somebody else to come along. And we've done various bits of the Bible, and I did them a Reader's Digest version of what I'm doing with you, a sort of dress rehearsal, this week. I don't lead the group, thank goodness, because someone else has to tell them the more difficult truths that are now believed by people that weren't when they were at school and all that. The leader is doing a comparison of the birth stories in Matthew and Luke for them next week. And I think that's a tough one because the questions are, when they contradict one another, which one is true historically and so on. And it's difficult to persuade people that historical truth, in our sense, wasn't the be-all and end-all of all this. They were much more concerned about the theological truth, the divine truth, which might not always have been exactly what happened and so on. I forget where you're. About the slaughter of the innocents. Yeah. All these other dates in our calendar, like the birth of the Virgin Mary and her immaculate or not conception on today, are all built upon when you find a date for the birth, you then work it all back from that. So, having tried to encourage you to come for a bit more detail next week, we will move on to Christmas, and sadly, Advent has to wait till the end. Thank you.